content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. In our first article today is entitled, Palestinian Christians at Chicago Conference Ask Fellow Believers to Stand Against Gaza War. This was written by Bob Smetana. Earlier this year, Lydia L. Sayah got the good news that her beloved grandmother was able to escape from Gaza. While thankful her relative was no longer in a war zone, the news was bittersweet. It's a blessing and a tragedy, said the 25-year-old El Sayaga, sitting on a bench outside of Parkview Community Church in Chicago's western suburbs. She should never have had to experience all that or had to leave her home in the first place. El Sayaga was one of several Palestinians speaking at the Church at the Crossroads conference, a three-day event held at Parkview this week that aims to rally Christians to speak up for their fellow believers in Gaza. The hope, organizers said, is to move American Christians from feeling bad about the war in Gaza to taking action to end it. We are at a crossroads, Palestinian theologian Daniel Banura told some 800 attendees at the conference's opening session on Thursday. There's a time right now for us to choose. Are we going to choose the path of peace or the path of violence? Several of the speakers expressed exasperation at Christians who expressed sympathy for the suffering in Gaza, but offer little beyond thoughts and prayers in response. Banura said that because America has supported Israel's military operations in Gaza, being passive is not an option. If you are not doing anything, you are doing something, he said. If you are in the U.S., then you are complicit. Gary Burge, a New Testament scholar and author of Whose Land, Whose Promise, rejected the notion espoused by Christian Zionists that the Bible requires Christians to support the modern-day state of Israel. That belief, common among evangelicals, has fueled much of the conservative Christian support for Israel. Modern Israel is not biblical Israel, Burge said. Let's be clear. Anton Tony Dyke, associate director of the Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice, which organized the conference, is a Palestinian Christian now living in Bolivia. He told conference attendees that linking current-day Israel to biblical history was one of the greatest theological scandals meant to excuse the violence of the Nakba, or catastrophe, as Israeli militias drove Palestinians from their villages at the founding of the Jewish state. But Deke was not interested in debates over Israel's right to exist. Though he believes the founding of Israel was unjust, the fact that Israel exists, he told Religion News Service in an interview, that's just reality. The question is, how can Israelis and Palestinians live together in peace? Let's live together, whether in two states or one state, he said. Dyke said Hamas committed war crimes during the October 7th attacks and made it clear that he does not support Hamas, but he also called for an end to what he called the genocide in Gaza. He also worries that American Christians are ignoring the violence and suffering in Gaza. It's very unfortunate in Christian circles that there is no pursuit of truth, Dyke said. There's no strong desire to know the truth of what's happening. The Reverend Munther Isaac, a Lutheran pastor based in the West Bank, gave perhaps the most pointed criticism of Christian Zionism of all the speakers. Do you know what the biggest problem with Christian Zionism is, he said? You cannot find Jesus in it. Isaac asked attendees to pause in commemoration of Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist and speaker who was killed while speaking at a Utah University campus. As Christians, we mourn with those who mourn, he said, adding that Christians should turn away from violence. Isaac's theme that U.S. Christian support of the war in Gaza undermines Christian witness was repeated by Faris Abraham, a Christian minister and CEO of Levant Ministries, which runs evangelicalistic events for young people in the Middle East. He asked participants to speak out against the violence in Gaza. The gospel witness and the church's witness is at stake, said Abraham. The world is watching to see how Christians will respond to this man-made evil in our beloved homeland. Abraham, a Liberty University graduate who identifies as an evangelical, said he wants the gospel to win and said that the gospel is about peace, not bloodshed. Simply put, we want the atrocities to stop. We want the bloodshed to stop. We want the famine and the starvation to end. And yes, we want the hostages to return back to their families, he said, a reference to Israelis taken captive by Hamas. In an interview, Abraham recounted how he came to the U.S. at age 18 because the Reverend Jerry Falwell, the school's founder, offered him a scholarship after meeting Abraham's father during a trip to the Holy Land. Abraham said that he has retained many friends at Liberty, despite disagreements about the Middle East. More than anything, he said, he wants other Christians to seek an end to violence in the Middle East and to focus on the Christian message of love and reconciliation. I want to live in peace with everybody, he said. El-Sayah said the Christians in the U.S. at times seem to see Palestinian Christians and other Palestinians as inconvenient, as if they were unwanted furniture that can be gotten rid of. She also said that Jesus is present with her people, even as they suffer. He is in Gaza, and he's experiencing the loss of every child and every pang of hunger and of the crushing of rubble, just like he did on the cross, she said, and he's rising again. Our second article is Authoritarian Rulers Aren't New. Here's what Herodotus, an early Greek historian, wrote about them. This article is taken from The Conversation, which is the commentary section of Religion News Service, and this was written by Debbie Felton, professor of classics at UMass Amherst. No king's rallies, good trouble protests, rage against the regime uprisings. These events in the first 7 months of President Donald Trump's second term, along with public opinion polls, show that many Americans are concerned about Trump's expansive use of executive power. Views on this issue often have a partisan slant. Republicans express more concern about presidential power when Democrats control the White House, and vice versa. But many in both parties prefer that U.S. political leaders work through established channels rather than through unconventional actions that may pose challenges to the Constitution and the rule of law, such as mass firings and large-scale deportations. As a professor of classics, I know that concerns about authoritarianism go back thousands of years. One early discussion appears in the work of the 5th century BCE Greek writer Herodotus, whose history, sometimes called histories, is considered the first great prose narrative in Western literature. In it, Herodotus analyzed the Persian invasion of Greece, the defining event of his time. To understand how Greece, a much smaller power, achieved a major victory over Persia, Herodotus explored the nature of effective leadership, which he saw as a critical factor in the conflict's outcome. Persia was already a vast empire when it invaded Greece, a tiny country made up of independent city-states. The Persians expected a quick and easy victory. Instead, the Greco-Persian Wars lasted over a decade, from 490 to 479 BCE. They ended with Greece defeating the Persians, a shocking upset. Consequently, Persia abandoned its westward expansion, while various Greek city-states formed a tenuous alliance that lasted nearly 50 years. To explain this unexpected outcome, Herodotus described how Persian and Greek societies developed before this crucial conflict. In his view, the fact that many Greek city-states had representative governments enabled the Greek victory. These systems allowed individuals to participate in discussing strategies and resulted in the Greeks uniting to fight for freedom. For example, when the Persian fleet was headed toward mainland Greece, the Athenian general Miltiades said, "Never before have we been in such extreme danger. If we give in to the Persians, we will suffer greatly under the tyrant Hippias." Herodotus tended to put his political philosophies into the mouths of historical figures such as Miltiades. He condensed his thoughts about government into what historians call the, quote, constitutional debate, end quote, a fictional conversation among three real characters, Persian noblemen named Otanes, Megabazus, and Darius. For centuries prior to invading Greece, Persia had been a small region inhabited by various ancient Iranian peoples and controlled by the neighboring kingdom of Media. Then in 550 BCE, King Cyrus II of Persia overthrew the Medes and expanded Persian territory in what became the Achaemenid Empire. Thanks to his effective leadership and tolerance for the customs and cultures he conquered, historians called him Cyrus the Great. His son and successor, Cambyses, was less successful. He added Egypt to the Persian Empire, but according to Herodotus, Cambyses acted erratically and cruelly. He desecrated the pharaoh's tomb, mocked the Egyptians' gods, and killed their sacred Apis bull. He also demanded that Persian judges change the laws so that he could marry his own sisters. After Cambyses died childless, various factions vied for the Persian throne. Herodotus set his discussion about alternative political systems in this unstable period. Otanes, the first speaker in the constitutional debate, says, "The time has passed for any one man among us to have absolute power." He recommends that the Persian people themselves handle state affairs. How can monarchy continue to be our norm when a monarch can do whatever he wants with no accountability whatsoever, Otanes asks. Even worse, a monarch disrupts the laws, as Cambyses did. Otanes favors rule by the many, which he calls isonomia, meaning equality under the law. In this system, he explains, politicians are elected and held responsible for their behavior and make decisions transparently. Today, unlike Otanes, Republican members of Congress appear reluctant to hold Trump responsible for anything or ensure transparency within the administration. Prominent Democrats, including U.S. Representative Jamie Raskin and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, are challenging the Trump administration actions that they view as lawless, such as freezing of funds authorized by Congress. Otani's fellow nobleman, Megabazus, agrees that the Persians should abolish monarchy, but he raises concerns about rule by the people. "The masses are useless. There's nothing more witless and violent than a crowd," Megabazus asserts. He believes commoners don't understand the intricacies of policymaking. Instead, megabosses suggest oligarchy or rule by a few. Choose the best man in Persia and let the best men in Persia and let them rule everyone else, he urges, because they will naturally come up with the best ideas. But megabosses doesn't explain who would qualify as the best men, or who should select them. The U.S. occasionally resembled an oligarchy, with small elite groups holding most political power. For example, Article 1, Section 3 of the original Constitution provided for election of senators by state legislators, not directly by the people. Senators were not elected by popular vote until the 17th Amendment passed in 1913. More recently, Trump has received millions of dollars in support from billionaire tech industry leaders such as Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Jeff Bezos, who hope to influence antitrust policy and deregulation. The Department of Government Efficiency, headed by Musk before he stepped down in May, is now run by young men with virtually no government experience. DOGE's cuts to programs such as humanitarian aid are wreaking havoc across the globe. What about monarchy? The third speaker, Darius, sees democracy and oligarchy as equally flawed. He points out that even well-intentioned oligarchs fight among themselves because each wants his own opinion to prevail. This leads to hatred and worse, much like the Trump-Musk relationship gone sour. Rather, Darius asserts, using good judgment, a monarch will be a flawless guardian of the people. He argues that since Persia was freed by one man, King Cyrus II, Persians should maintain their traditional monarchy. Darius doesn't explain how to ensure a monarch's good judgment, but his argument wins out. It had to, since in reality Darius becomes Persia's next king. Kings or shahs ruled Persia. It became known as Iran in 1935, until the Iranian Revolution of 1979 eliminated the monarchy and established the Islamic Republic of Iran. Trump is not technically a monarch, but some people believe he acts like one. He and his administration have ignored court orders, preempted the powers of Congress, and sought to silence his critics by attacking protected free speech. Lessons from Herodotus. Herodotus himself was largely pro-democracy, but his constitutional debate doesn't endorse one form of government. Instead, it highlights principles of good leadership. These include accountability, moderation, and respect for nomos, a Greek term encompassing the concepts of custom and law. Herodotus emphasizes, formerly, great cities have become small, while small cities have become great. Human fortune changes constantly, and Persia's failure to conquer Greece is just one example. History has seen the rise and fall of many world powers. Is the United States next? Herodotus viewed the Persian monarchy, whose kings believed their own authority was paramount, as the weakness that led to their astounding defeat in 479 BCE. Our third article for this episode is entitled Rapture Again: Why the End Times Never End. This was written by Andre Henry for Religion News Service. The end is near again. Hysteria and mockery rained down in equal measure after a South African pastor proclaimed Tuesday, September 23rd, as the day of the rapture, a reference to the doctrine that Jesus will suddenly cause billions of Christians to vanish, triggering the final countdown to Judgment Day. On social media, rapture.com talk showed believers selling their cars before the great departure. Others made jokes about Jesus' punctuality as a projected date arrived in different time zones. The rapture, however, is no laughing matter. It's not because it's likely to ever come through for its prognosticators, but because even in its unreality, it has serious real-world consequences. Rapture theology is racist theology. It upholds some of the worst injustices of human history. It's time we left it behind. Rapture theology became popular in the United States during a time of racial reckoning. Born decades before the Civil War, it didn't take off in the States until the Reconstruction period, when the theology was championed by the ex-Confederate Cyrus Scofield, who continued to push the racist curse of Ham doctrine long after it had outlived its popularity. Some Christian leaders interpreted the post-Civil War racial revolution as the destabilization of society, in fact, just the white supremacist order to which they were accustomed, and is said to herald the rapture. The abolition of slavery, the establishment of birthright citizenship, and the giving of the franchise to blacks, along with the rising popularity of Darwinism and more liberal perspectives on the Bible, could all be read as signs of the end times. The Civil War itself was horrific enough to convince Christians the world was beyond repair and to make the prospect of escape to heaven compelling. But end times prophecy was also psychologically useful in that it enabled white Christians to reframe the unpredictable and terrifying advancement of civil rights as something predictable, biblical prophecy. The white world, as they knew it, built on the cornerstone of slavery, was ending. But no worries. The world is supposed to get worse before Jesus swoops in to save them, according to doctrine. They applied the same principle to participating in the work of racial reckoning. In his 2008 book, Race, A Theological Account, J. Cameron Carter, a professor of religious studies at Indiana University, writes, "If Christian hope functions as an evacuation plan from history, rather than a call to repair its wounds, it risks colluding with the structures that wound in the first place." That seems to be what happened in U.S. history. Evangelical paragons such as Dwight L. Moody used rapture theology to discourage social action that would have further advanced racial reforms. Moody's revivals, theologian Nathaniel Grimes wrote, prompted many to forget earthly concerns. As Moody put it, the moment a person becomes heavenly minded and gets his heart and affection sets on things above, then life becomes beautiful. This shift toward heavenly mindedness coincided with a drop in support for Reconstruction. Moody's peers and predecessors used the same theological staff to jam the wheels of racial progress. Only when Christ comes again will the little white children of Alabama walk hand in hand with little black children, quipped Billy Graham after the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 speech at the March on Washington. The late John MacArthur parroted Moody almost verbatim in a 2017 interview about the Black Lives Matter movement, saying that when one becomes a Christian, the object of life is no longer to fix past injustices. The object of life is now to proclaim Christ. Once people come to Christ, all other issues fall away. And when the gospel changes your life, you go from social issues to spiritual issues. In short, rapture teaching is a bedrock of a theology of irresponsibility, popularized to pardon white Christians from the work of racial repentance and social repair. By this logic, Christian adherents had better stay out of the way of injustice and atrocity in order to hasten Jesus' coming. These theological ideas are at play in the genocide in Gaza today. Rapture theology is a pillar of Christian Zionism, which holds that a precondition of the end times is the Jews' return to Israel, where they will accept Jesus as the true Messiah. Apart from the essential anti-Semitism of this scheme, rapture theology further perpetuates racism in justifying the ongoing dispossession and genocide of the Palestinian people as a necessary consequence of bringing about the Second Coming. All of which prompts the question, why do so many Christians cling so strongly to such a harmful idea? Many will answer that the rapture is described in the Bible. Many of the passages cited in rapture doctrine, however, are misinterpretations based on absurdly literal readings of biblical passages taken out of context. When Jesus says, one will be taken and the other left, in the view of many biblical many Bible scholars, he's talking about the imminent fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, not the end of the world. Similarly, the dreaded mark of the beast in the New Testament's book of Revelation was probably understood by its first century audience as code for the Roman Emperor Domitian, not Presidents Donald Trump or Barack Obama. The famous Pauline passage that speaks of believers being caught up in the air to meet Jesus, even conservative scholars such as N.T. Wright have pointed out, comes as Paul is talking about people welcoming a dignitary and escorting them into town, and says nothing about believers going to heaven. Those who use the book of Revelation to prop up the rapture should read the book to the end, where God creates a new heaven and new earth, and a new Jerusalem descends on it. Taken literally or figuratively, the text suggests that God's apocalyptic vision in the Christian tradition is a restoration of our planet, not abandonment. So where does the rapture come from? The rapture emerged in the 1830s in the visions of a Scottish girl named Margaret MacDonald, who dreamed that Jesus returned in two phases, first to take the faithful Christians to heaven, then to return to earth to deliver the full extent of divine wrath. Almost immediately, people began predicting when these visions would come true, leading most immediately to the great disappointment of 1844, when Baptist preacher William Miller led thousands of parishioners to sell their possessions. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.